From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, August 30th, 2019, and we have an interesting show lined up for you this morning. We're going to go with, I guess, maybe sort of ideological bookends here on the Dave Graham Show today. We're going to open the show with Guy Page. He is the publisher of the Vermont Water Cooler, State House, and State House Headliners, two publications, also a strong conservative and a Christian and a Trump supporter, and going to get a perspective from Guy in the first little bit of the show here. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Bill Boardman. He is just out with a new book, which is a collection of his essays that he's written over the past several years for reader-supported news. And he is a critic of the United States government and policy, most often from a pretty left perspective. So we're gonna. I've said many, many times on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEB FM and AM, we welcome people from all points of view here, and this is a case in point here, I think, on this Friday morning. So stay with us. It's going to be a roller coaster ride. I want to introduce my first guest, who is Guy Page, as I mentioned, and he's in the studio with us this morning. And thanks for coming in, Guy.
Glad to be here, Dave.
And we have a couple of interesting news items going on that we sort of promised one another we would talk about this morning. And I appreciate your willingness to come in. And the first thing is more developments in this story that's been rolling through the week on the University of Vermont Medical Center getting a letter from the United States Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights. And the letter told the hospital that the hospital had behaved improperly by requiring, coercing, and deceptively coercing a nurse into participating in an abortion procedure at the Burlington Hospital. Now it appears there are more nurses stepping forward who have similar concerns. Guy Page, tell us about this.
Sure. So a couple years ago, the Ali Stickney is a former president of Planned Parenthood of New England, our CEO, is appointed the chair of the board of University of Vermont Medical Center. In short order, the hospital is doing abortions, elective abortions. So many nurses and some doctors complained about this and said, look, we don't want to have anything to do with this. And so there was a, I guess you might say, sort of a lukewarm policy, a conscience policy put in place. But then what happened was a nurse was brought in for what she was told was going to be a sort of a miscarriage and taking care of that tragic situation. Turns out, once she gets in there, the doctor says, actually, this is an abortion, and I, you know, don't hate me, but you got to do it. And they knew. And so they deceived her and went against their own so-called policy of conscience protection.
Yeah, and as I said yesterday on the Dave Graham Show, Thursday morning's edition, I don't think that's proper. I certainly don't think anybody should be forced to participate in any kind of work that violates their own religious beliefs. I think that, however, I will also say that I think all of these questions need to be sorted out way ahead of time. I mean, there should not be any situation where this person is even faced with, do I participate in an abortion? This nurse who is pro-life, who is, you know, ideologically or religiously or ethically or whatever opposed to abortion, you know, I've seen the bumper sticker before, and it's usually on a person on the car of a person who supports abortion rights. It says, if you don't believe in abortion, don't have one. I think it also should mean that if you don't believe in abortion, don't participate in performing one. That's a pretty basic idea. In a place like UVM Medical Center, however, there are a ton of places you can work in that organization where you wouldn't be faced with this. If you work in orthopedics, if you work in cardiology, rheumatology, oncology, I don't know, offcology. I mean, there's just tons of medical specialties out there where this question just never comes up. And you, so, you know, you're a registered nurse. You want to participate in the healing arts and the helping profession there. That's a lovely thing and an honorable thing. I have nurses in my own life and love them very much, and really respect the heck out of what they do. And I think that there are ample opportunities under that professional umbrella for sort of like being a teacher and deciding that, I'm not religious. I'm not going to teach at a religious school. Get a job in a public school or an independent school. As a teacher, I'm deciding I am religious and I don't want to work in a public school because they teach evolution. Get a job in a religious school. I mean, there's plenty of flexibility out there in life, folks. And it's just a shame to me that this thing even had to come up. What do you think about that guy?
Well, I think that, imagine that you're a nurse who's working, you got in this profession because you care about people, you have a sense of maybe faith-based compassion, and you really want to help people, and you go to work for a hospital that does a good job at that. It's also essentially the only hospital in the state, the way, mm-hmm. because they're taking over so much of the hospital network. And everything's great until they change the policy. And yep. so we, the we as in people with religious conscience, are expected to now change our specialty, change our everything. No, actually, there's a reason there's a First Amendment that protects the right to religion, which is not just religious ceremony, it's religious conviction and conscience as well.
Okay, so the patient comes into the hospital, and normally a patient has a right to decide what kind of medical care the patient is going to get. A doctor comes in and asks a 85-year-old patient, do you want to go on chemo? And the patient has to decide, do I want to go on chemo and have months of sickness and then maybe end up dying of cancer? Right. Or do I want to say, I'm 85 years old, I have cancer, and I don't want chemo? That's that's mm-hmm. an independent right of the patient.
Indeed.
To decide that. And so now a patient comes in and says, and the decision is, do I want to continue with a pregnancy that I have or terminate mm-hmm. it? The patient wants to exercise that right. Mm-hmm. The state law allows that to be exercised mm-hmm. in Vermont. And then what happens?
Then it's up to the hospital to schedule the procedure without compromising someone's First Amendment religious rights.
Okay, so
they should go ahead and do that and not deceive them and trick them into coming in and forcing them to.
Yeah, I agree with you there. The person should not be tricked or coerced into performing the abortion. What if the person is told, we have a new policy here in this department, which would be OB or maybe the surgical suites or maybe the ER, right? These are the departments in the hospital where this new policy might actually come into play. We also have many other departments at the hospital. I listed some of the specialties where, mm-hmm. People come in for orthopedic procedures, or they come in for, any number of gastroenterology. There's just tons of specialties. And I've seen, I have a good friend who's a nurse who just went from working in a rheumatology office to working in a surgical suite. She decided she wanted to change, same organization. She's, same paycheck and same parking place in the parking lot, but she goes to a different mm-hmm. part of the hospital because she wanted a change in her work. And so that's, it seems to me that is the solution here. And I don't get why we even had to get into this fight. I mean, it seems like it's bad management on the part of the hospital. And by the way, I will say that I've reached out multiple times over the past couple of days to the hospital's PR office about, asking them to come on the Dave Graham Show and talk to us about what's going on here, get their perspective. I reached out to the nurses' union and I said, what do you all have to say about that? Nobody wants to talk about this very much, it seems. I've not gotten real positive responses on getting anybody on the show so far. But, they're obviously welcome to come on the Dave Graham Show anytime. I have a week off next week, but I'll be back on the 9th. And if they want to talk to us then, that's great too. We have a caller on the line, Rich from Huntington. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, gentlemen. Dave, I don't want to make this about you, but I just want to ask as an example what you think. So let me present a scenario here. I think we've established that the person who was involved, the practitioner, is not discriminating against the individual because they're, a single mom or doesn't like the color of their skin or something like that. She did not want to involve herself in the procedure or
right.
the event, right?
Yep.
Okay, so I think that's pretty obvious. So, and it's And because we have a law that accommodates that, because we have a First Amendment that protects religious freedom.
Right.
Now, what would you think about a person who is also a different kind of practitioner, let's say makes wedding cakes, and doesn't have a problem with the people getting married, but has a problem with participating in the event because they find a religious objection? Do you not see the same parallel here? Let me be explicit here. Baking a cake for a gay wedding.
Yeah, I mean, now we get into the public accommodations law.
Well, do we, though? Think about that.
And, yeah, we do, because this is, you're set up in business. It's sort of like you own a motel and you decide for religious reasons, and people used to cite religious reasons for not wanting to rent to people of color, your motel rooms to people of color. And they were very serious about their Christian belief that they didn't have to rent to people of color. And it just depends on where you draw the line here, doesn't it? I mean, I think in the case of an outfit that goes into business as a bakery, and somebody comes to and this bakery is in the business of making wedding cakes, and anybody who comes in the door saying, I'd like a wedding cake, and I'd like it to be delivered to such and such a wedding venue on Saturday the 16th, you make the wedding cake and you deliver it on Saturday the 16th, and you know, whatever else happens there isn't really your concern. You want to make the best cake you can and get a good reputation for making a delicious wedding cake, so the other people at the wedding, when they get married, they call your shop.
Well, again, the end result is the same. They have a wedding cake and they have a satisfactory wedding, or a person goes in to terminate a pregnancy and they're satisfied their pregnancy was terminated. But
yeah.
I'm talking about the difference in public accommodation law is discriminating against the individuals or individual seeking the service versus the service itself. In this case, there was no discrimination against saying, I can't do an abortion on a black woman or a single pregnant woman, something like that.
No, Rich, it's not really parallel then, because...
Well, that's what I wanted to know. If you're going to draw the parallel, or you're going to make a distinction.
No, I'm making a distinction here because obviously, I mean, it's obvious. This is not a public accommodation case in the sense that somebody comes in off the street seeking a service from the hospital and is turned away because of his or her, ethnic or religious or whatever national origin background. That's not the case. That's not what happened here.
That's not what happened with the wedding cake either, though. The discrimination, and we had a similar case in Vermont at an inn up in Lindenville.
Yeah, I recall.
You remember that? Okay.
Yep.
Where, again, their claim was, and I side with them, that they had a problem with participating in an event. They had no problem with accommodating the individuals seeking the service. But that's not the way the Vermont Human Rights Commission saw it.
Yeah.
So
all right. Well,
double standard here. So.
Okay. Thanks for the call. I got to go. Guy, what do you think? Is there? I think we're really on two completely different roads here. Mm-hmm. Don't you?
Yes, I do. I think I see what he's trying to say, but they're fundamentally two different situations.
Ruth from Sheldon's on the line. Good morning, Ruth. Ruth, are you there?
Our hospital did not do elective abortions. They only changed their policy 2 years ago. Most nurses would not want to participate in doing abortions. That's not why they went to nurses training. They went to help people, and they don't see abortion as helping people. But let's look at it from the nurse's point of view. In one room, A baby is born premature, and every effort is done to take care of this baby. But in another room, a same-age baby is being pulled apart limb by limb. Now, how can you justify that? How can you expect medical people to participate in that? They don't want to, and it's as simple as that. Why did UVM Medical Center change its policy after 44 years? And why did they not have... they said they had an ethics committee, but they didn't allow the people who are involved in having to do these things to participate in the discussion.
Got it, Ruth. Thanks for the call. I'm going to go to Steve from Essex. Good morning, Steve.
I don't know what's so hard to understand about this. This is not taking out a gallbladder. This is killing a human being. Can you imagine when you take the little baby out and it's still moving? What do? Hit him in the head so he stops moving? That's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for the call, Steve. Guy Page, obviously you have some support out there for your views on this topic, and I would only say that that for whatever reason, and there are reasons that are articulated by many people in Vermont, this is a legal procedure, and it's actually considered a right of women to have access to abortion in the state of Vermont. It's codified now in state law. We expect it'll soon be codified in the Vermont Constitution, and the and then when that is the case, when you have a alcohol is legal in Vermont, so we have liquor stores in Vermont, because it wouldn't really count for anything to have alcohol legal in Vermont if we didn't have liquor stores. So in other words, if you're going to have a service legal in your state, it makes sense that you're going to have some institution that is going to be providing that service. Now, you have mentioned repeatedly, Guy, that this is the dominant, largest, all-controlling healthcare institution in the state of Vermont. And imagine if repairing a broken arm were as controversial as abortion. And this hospital, and we were having this debate about whether the hospital should be allowed to repair broken arms. People have a right to a medical procedure, and then you need to have presumably a medical institution able and willing to deliver that service. And again, I don't know. I do think that patients have certain rights about making decisions about the care they receive, and that the hospital really, if it doesn't deliver this service, where were people going for abortions in the Burlington area before a couple of years ago?
Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
Which you want to shut down as well.
It's not my call, is it? I would love it.
Yeah.
If abortions were not being performed.
I get it.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
But that'd be fine with me.
But the law in the state of Vermont, I mean, you argued that passionately at the State House this past spring. You came up on the losing end of that debate. Mm-hmm. The law in the state of Vermont says abortions are allowed. And
yeah. You know what, Dave, though? The law used to say that people could own slaves, too.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make it right, and that doesn't mean that some receptionist at the medical center, for example, needs to become essentially the receptionist for an abortion clinic, having people come in and doing intakes. It's not just the nurses. It's basically making people of conscience complicit in something that I have a friend who she's staying up night, having nightmares, real stress over this, saying, good grief, I didn't ask for this, but there's blood on my hands.
And I will say that there are many, many jobs out there, including some in which I have participated in my own life, in where changes are imposed by the employer. The employer comes out and says, we're going to start doing X. And the employee says, I don't really like this X. And the employee then goes through a calculus and says, can I tolerate X, or do I need to leave and find a different job? Okay. And the employee says, I'm going to tolerate X, and continues to come to work. Maybe gets used to X and starts to realize that maybe it's not that bad an idea after all. Mm. Then the employer comes out and says, we're going to start doing Y. And the employees mm-hmm. and the employee says, and the process repeats itself until the employee finally says, all right, I've had enough of this. I'm going to go somewhere else. And that is that's part of the free market labor market in our country.
The Constitution tends to protect the rights, conscience rights of employees over the market desires of employers. I mean, for example, what happened, I'm not saying this is ever going to happen, but what if WDEV decided that their whole audience was all against white privilege, and suddenly, sorry, no more talk show people with white skin.
I'd be done.
Well, but you might have a constitutional issue there.
I mean, there are
I'm not saying that would happen. That's a ridiculous example.
Yeah,
okay,
but I think
it's an example.
This might actually raise issues of anti-discrimination laws and so on.
You think?
But based on you can't discriminate against people on the color of their skin
or their religion
or their religion, and UVMMSC doesn't have to discriminate against people on their religion. They can say to the person, you have the right yourself to decide you don't want to involve yourself in certain procedures.
So you can leave.
So
you have the right to leave.
Or we can provide you with another job in one of the many other departments at our hospital where this procedure never occurs. That seems to me to be there's an accommodation which seems to me to solve the whole problem, and why that isn't an obvious and standard procedure for new employees coming in. And it ought to be on the employee, because the employer, no employer wants to ask in a job interview, by the way, what religion are you? That's really fraught and shouldn't happen, basically.
Sure.
So the employer could say to the employee, by the way, on your own ticket, on your own volition, you can say you have a religious, moral, ethical, whatever, philosophical objection to certain procedures. And if you don't have any objections to any procedures we do here, and here's the list, you'll sort of be in the general hiring pool. If you have objections to certain procedures, I was just talking to somebody the other day who was really strongly philosophically opposed against circumcision. She was calling it male genital mutilation, parallel to female genital mutilation that gets a lot of bad press, especially overseas. And so fine, she shouldn't work in the part of the hospital where circumcisions occur. That's just bottom, and the hospital ought to accommodate that and tell her, here are the other 80 places in the hospital you can work without having to encounter this problem. So.
But, Dave, it's not all about the paycheck and the parking spot. It's also people who are in ER medicine, and it's a calling. It's something, I'm so good at this. This is so fulfilling.
ER may be
off
the list.
Oh, and by the way,
yep.
You can't do that anymore because?
Because you don't want to. Because it's now going to include this certain procedure, and you don't want to participate, and that's fine.
Maybe
we have this whole list of other jobs in other departments we could give you.
The almighty hospital perhaps could accommodate the employee. I don't think
we're going to get to the bottom of this one, Guy, but thanks for trying. Guy Page has been my guest this first half hour. Stay with the Dave Graham Show. We're going to be talking about Moorfest coming up, and maybe get some words from a longtime Vermont radio guy who's now in Florida, who's going to tell us a little bit about hurricane preparations down there. Should be a fun second half hour and a fun second hour of the Dave Graham Show. Stay with us, folks. Yep.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back continuing into the second half hour of our program this morning. It's August 30th? What happened to the month of August? What happened to the summer? That's what I want to know. Gee whiz. That's going by crazy fast, and here we are coming right up on September as of the end of this weekend. I guess Sunday is September 1st and into fall. That's the next thing coming, folks. And then winter. Don't mention winter. All righty, then. We got a good segment lined up for you here, and we want to hear all about Moorfest. It's an upcoming town fair next weekend in Moortown, and we have as our guest the chair of the Moorfest committees, Katrina Brackett, who I gather is a Moortown resident.
Yes, I am.
That would make a lot of sense. Katrina, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And what is Moorfest? Talk to us about what this event is.
It's really just a free community celebration. It started several years ago and as kind of as a town energy committee sponsored event, and has kind of just morphed into a day to just hang out and have fun, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And this happens on actually a week from tomorrow, right? Saturday the 7th?
Yes, Saturday the 7th from 3 to dusk when the fireworks are.
Oh, okay. Where in Moortown do you hold this event?
We, between the town office and the elementary school, the rec fields right there.
And I'm trying to remember, is that on
100B?
100B, okay.
Yeah.
And what kind of crowds? Let me go back a little bit. And how many years have you been doing this?
Well, it's been Moorfest this is Moorfest's fourth year. But it actually started in 2014 and just kind of has changed a couple different times.
Mm-hmm. And is there still any sort of an energy theme behind it, or is it?
No, it's just more about community. It kind of changed to more of a community event after Irene, in when was it 2015, it changed, the school took the event over, mm-hmm. and it turned into more of like a Spring into Moortown Family Fun Day.
I see. And yeah. it, this is, of course, right around, I guess, two days ago now, was the anniversary of Tropical Storm yep. Irene, and I remember Moortown got whacked in that
Oh, yeah. yeah. So yeah. it was in 2016, I think, when the office was finally finished, mm-hmm. the town office. So that's yep. they celebrated that at Moorfest.
I see. Okay. And what kinds of activities happen at Moorfest?
We normally have a car show. We do not mm-hmm. this year.
Okay.
So we've decided to do Touch a Truck. Uh-huh. It's 90% families that come.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
everything's free. There's no entry fee. We, of mm-hmm. course, take donations.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we thought Touch a Truck would be an easy addition.
Yeah, and the kids do love that. They
oh yeah.
What trucks do you have coming in? You know, you have some good ones lined up.
Yeah, there'll be a race car or two, fire trucks, the town trucks. Mm-hmm. The Vermont National Guard is coming with their climbing wall, so I'm hoping that they bring some sort of awesome vehicle uh-huh. to play on.
yeah. And the that's typically younger kids who get into the touch a truck thing, or is it are teenagers doing that now too?
No, I don't think so. I think my 10-year-old might be like his last big
touch a truck.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But I've seen that happening before at various festivals and so on. And when you see a 4 to 6 year old crawling around on mm-hmm. on these vehicles, it's and you can just get wind of the joy that they're experiencing.
Yeah.
It is kind of fun to watch, and so that's pretty cool. What about food vendors and so
on?
We
do. We have just a couple food vendors this year. We have a hot dog vendor, and then we also have our fire department will do their corn roast, and they're going to do pulled pork and coleslaw as well.
I might have to come over for that.
Right? But we also have someone doing a coffee cart uh-huh. and a cheesecake cart, ice cream. And for food, that's about it. But we also have a craft beer tent.
Ah, okay.
It's PTO sponsored. It's one of their big fundraisers. Mm-hmm. They fundraise for all the programs at the school. So, and parents that come with kids, what's better than having a beer tent?
Sometimes you got to have a cold beer.
Right?
And what's the craft beers coming by on Saturday?
Otter Creek is uh-huh. who did it last year. They'll yep. be back again this year, but Lawson's has also joined them this year.
Oh, okay. That's some pretty stiff competition
yes.
for Otter Creek. And,
yes.
Well, both of them, really.
Mm-hmm.
They're both good beers, and I do have a taste for that sip of sunshine. It's pretty darn good. And the any other rides or activities? Or?
We do some old-fashioned kids games, you know, like mm-hmm. sack races and three-legged races. There's also craft vendors. There's a few town committees that will have booths with information. And then we have entertainment. We have over at the church at the beginning of the day, there'll be a singer called Messenger. And then Rusty Deweese will be there.
Oh, wow.
At 4:30 to stop by. He's doing a tiny town hall tour this fall. Huh. And so he's there to promote his show in Moortown in the fall.
Wow. And so is he doing a little performance?
He is. He's going to do a little performance yep. right before the last band comes on, which is the Mad Mountain Scramblers.
Yeah, of course, Rusty's a good friend of WDEV.
Oh, yeah.
He's been on this station many times, and he's a great local personality here in Vermont, and just he does a wonderful job, I think, with his storytelling and his humor and the whole thing is if you haven't caught Rusty's act, this might be a chance for you to do so, folks. 4:30 at the Moorfest celebration on the September 7th upcoming. Of course, this time of year, there's a lot of stuff that is happening along these lines where you want to get to the town or the county, your regional fair. Obviously, Champlain Valley Fair is going on right now. The Champlain Valley Exposition, I should say. The Tunbridge Fair is coming up. WDEV, the Dave Graham Show, is going to be at the Tunbridge Fair on September the 12th. That's actually 2 weeks from yesterday. Looking forward to that, and I'll try not to eat too much fried dough. And but the Moorfest sounds like a really cool thing for a small town to do. Are there other similar events, other times a year where the community comes out, or is this the big one?
Definitely not in Moortown. This is the big one. And it's not just for Moortown. It's for everybody.
You know,
throughout the Valley, Waterbury, everybody.
Sure.
The fireworks show is, I'm a big fireworks fan. I grew up in Michigan. I've seen a lot of big shows.
Uh-huh.
And Waterbury puts on a good show. And it's the same people. It's North Star that does our fireworks. But the location is, you're like in a bowl and they're right on top of you. So they're very, very good.
That sounds like a lot of fun, actually. And of course, North Star is really becoming quite well known, not just in Vermont, but around the Northeast and even up into Canada. They just won a comp. They went up to Sherbrooke a few weeks ago and came in second, I think, in a in an international competition. And fireworks are getting high tech these days. They're choreographing them to music, and I don't know if that's going to be in your show, but they are really getting to be more and more into new technologies applied to that old art of fireworks displays. And so that North Star, they are a player in that realm.
And they're great too, because we fundraise for this whole thing to keep it free.
You know,
we have sponsors that donate money almost every year, but they know that we don't have tens of thousands of dollars to spend on fireworks.
Got it. Okay. So they try to accommodate your limited budget.
Absolutely,
like. And that's another community spirited aspect of this thing is that Moortown is doing Moorfest on a bit of a shoestring, and that's okay. You know, that is part of the challenge and the coming together of a community when everybody sort of gets into that chip it in spirit and pay it forward, whatever you want to call it, and that's a terrific thing. So once again, Moorfest is going to be on September 7th, starts at around 3 p.m., goes to dusk when there are fireworks. A lot of the traditional fixings of a good town fair, events for kids, the whole family, a beer tent for the grown-ups, and all in all, it sounds like a lot of fun. And Katrina Brackett, I want to thank you so much for coming in this morning to let us know about this. And I wish you the best of luck, and I hope that you get a good crowd next Saturday.
Thank you very much.
A lot of folks are watching the weather reports from down south and looking at this Hurricane Dorian, which seems to be barreling toward the Florida coast. There's quite a bit of concern about where it's going to hit and some uncertainty about that. And We have the opportunity this morning, I just found out when I came in, to check in with Mike Calhoun. Mike is a longtime Vermont broadcaster who's now down in Florida, and we're going to get a live shot or something like that from our good friend Mike Calhoun. Mike, you're down in the West Palm Beach area, is that right?
That's correct, and wish I was in Vermont.
I imagine this would be a good time to be in. We're actually having a spectacular day here in Vermont right now. And by the way, I thank you for joining us on short notice this morning. This is really kind of you to get on the phone with us here at WDEV. Refresh me now a little bit about your Vermont broadcast career. You worked at a number of different stations up here and then moved south. When was that?
The 80s, I went to work for Senator Leahy as his press secretary, and then off to NBC in Washington, and then down to Florida.
Wow, okay. And are you retired now, or are you still doing any work?
Well, sort of retired. I'll get called in here from the stations that I worked for probably over the weekend, because they're going to be shorthanded and that kind of stuff. But
sure.
It's going to be a fun time, I'm sure.
Yeah. So the weather, I'm guessing, right now down there is hot but pretty nice, or are you starting to see some evidence of this coming storm right now already?
No, it's partly cloudy. It's about 85 degrees and a light breeze. It's not going to be that way come 72 hours, but, it's not a bad day today.
And it sounds like the storm is scheduled to make landfall on, what, Monday or so? Is that the estimate?
Yeah, the latest estimate is sometime Monday afternoon, and it looks like it's going to be right along the coast where I am, just a little bit south of West Palm Beach.
Wow, and they're able to pinpoint it 72 hours out, and they're able to predict. So it would be what, coming in around down more toward Fort Lauderdale or somewhere in that area, or what do you? Do they have an idea?
They have a pretty good idea. As they get closer, that cone narrows, and they get a better shot of where the landfall is, but the truth of the matter is the storm's going to be pretty wide, so it's going to affect most of the east coast of Florida at landfall.
Yeah, yeah. Now, somebody was asking me this morning if I thought it would be a direct hit on Mar-a-Lago and if that would be considered an act of God, and I said, well, you know, I think that just by sheer physicality of the thing, the chances are it will not be a direct hit on Mar-a-Lago because there's a lot of coast down there, and then that'll be called an act of God. So, whether you want a direct hit on Mar-a-Lago or not, you got to be careful about these predictions, right?
Well, and I got to be careful about wishing it on Mar-a-Lago because I'm less than a mile from it. So, it would be pretty close.
That would be kind of close to your house. So let's hope that it avoids Mar-a-Lago altogether by maybe a couple hundred miles. I gather you would like that.
It'd be nice if I was watching. The Weather Channel turns out to be the biggest cable channel in Florida these days.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
When you're watching it and you're watching all those spaghetti models and you're hoping for the one that veers off to the right and goes out to sea, but that one's disappeared this morning, so
yeah,
it looks like landfall on the east coast.
Long term, Florida is not looking good on the climate change maps. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's got some problems. I've even noticed it over the last decade or so that the summers are even a little bit hotter than normal. We just had the hottest July on record in Florida, so
yikes!
There's some to it. Yeah.
Now you've been there for years. Do you do anything differently this July than you have in past summers?
I spent a lot of time inside in the air conditioning, and try to go to the beach earlier in the morning.
But, yeah.
It's those kind of adaptations.
Yeah, yeah. It seems as though, when I mentioned the climate change maps, you actually look out 100 years, and supposedly there's a chance that a lot of Florida is going to be underwater. And the water's already come.
Yeah, that's part of their concern this morning is what they call king tides, which is higher than normal high tides. Mm-hmm. Those tend to happen towards the end of the month in August and September. And, bring in Dorian, and Miami Beach is very concerned about heavy flooding from this.
Yeah, I've seen video footage of seawater coming up through storm drains and stuff, and that doesn't look like a very good situation.
No, and, Florida, most of Florida is not, the highest point in South Florida is the Broward County landfill at 65 feet above sea level, so.
Yikes. Is that just high because they piled up a bunch of trash there or what?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. If you're driving south on 95, you can see it. You see this mound and you're wondering what the high ground is, and then you realize it's garbage.
Yeah, well, that's human impact on the planet for sure, and there's a lot of that in Florida. Tell me your own situation there. Are you feeling confident? Are you going to leave? Are you going to stay? What's your deal?
Well, I'm going to wait and see what they tell me to do. But, today is going to be putting up shutters, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then, it's going to be a weekend of waiting to see what they do. If it's going to be a Category 4 and it's going to make a direct hit here, then I am inside in an evacuation zone and they will ask us to leave.
Yeah, and you'll follow that instruction? I know some people are stubborn and they say, I'm going to stick it out. But what's the...
Well, I've been through a couple of Category 3s. I've never been through a Category 4 close up.
Yeah.
And, 130 mile an hour winds are pretty substantial.
That is severe.
A lot of the housing built in the, before the 1970s isn't going to stand up to that.
Yeah, that could be a really, wherever it does hit, it sounds like it could be a pretty devastating storm. And I just, I'm hoping for the best and thinking that, may it suddenly curve back out to sea or something or just, weaken somewhat. It's a tough looking storm right now on the track where it is. And you hope that it doesn't, you hope that the impact is minimal, but not so sure here. Mike, I got a few minutes to go here, and I wanted to invite our listeners out there. If they have any questions for Mike Calhoun, who's down in South Florida awaiting the arrival of Hurricane Dorian, trying to decide should I go or should I stay now, as the old song says. 244-1777 if you'd like to talk with Mike. That's the local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255. And really appreciate your willingness to join us this morning, Mike. Your own situation there, you're saying you're on the fence right now. You're waiting for instructions about whether to evacuate. But if you get the evacuation order, you're going to be in a wicked traffic jam, right?
Yeah, they tend to issue the order early enough so that most people can clear. And what they're asking you to do is not get on the interstate and try to drive 300 miles.
Uh-huh.
The evacuation zone instructions usually involve, like, you know, go inland 10 miles or go, you know, go to stay with someone in the western communities, that kind of thing, to get away from the coast.
Yeah.
Their biggest concern is flooding.
I would imagine, yeah. The water comes rushing in off the high tide there, and wow, you could be in... how close to the beach are you, or the shore?
I'm about a half a mile from the beach, and in this section of all along the east coast of Florida, you also have the intercoastal waterway,
yeah,
which is behind the coast, and that, Lake Worth is the community that I'm in.
I see.
And that's probably 300 yards from my house.
The intercoastal waterway?
Yes.
So are you on the land side of that, or are you actually on the sort of in the barrier islands there?
No, I'm on the land side.
Okay, I see. And my dad actually lived in my late dad lived in Boynton Beach for a number of years down there, so you guys are practically neighbors. But
just south of me, not far at all.
Yep. And when was the last time a big storm like this hit that part of Florida?
It's been a while. I was thinking probably Hurricane Charley about 8-10 years ago.
Yeah.
The weirdest summer I ever went through was when we had Francis and Jean, two Category 3 hurricanes, 11 days apart. And, you know, we just got power back from the first one, and bingo, and out it went again. So, I've been through 6 hurricanes in South Florida.
Well, let's talk to me about power. Do you have a generator, or do you have, and is there much food in your freezer you worry about and that kind of thing, or how you set up there?
Yeah, you tend to make some adjustments. The first one is, you know, you tend to start to eat the frozen stuff before the storm hits.
Yep.
So that your freezer is empty.
Yeah.
And then, the power goes out, and you try to eat the refrigerated stuff, and then, you're on canned goods and dry goods for, you know, week, 7-10 days.
Yeah.
And hopefully power comes back.
Well, you know, I think it sounds like you got the right attitude about the whole thing. You're just kind of trying to handle it as practically as you can. And I really wish you the best of luck and that everything goes as smoothly as it can, given the circumstances. And Mike Calhoun, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM and AM.
Thank you very much for having me, Dave, and a shout-out to the Spalding High School class of 1969's 50th anniversary in Barrie.
Oh, wow. Are you an alumnus of Spalding?
I am, indeed.
Wow. Are you going to come up for it?
No, they just had it.
I see.
And I was hoping to come up for it, but now, you know, this sort of locked me in place.
Yeah.
But it was a couple weekends ago.
Life happens, and so does weather, right? Yeah. Hey, Mike, thanks again. We'll talk. We appreciate it. Don't be shy. Call DEV in the next few days and fill the folks, whoever's on duty here, in on what's happening down there.
You got it, Dave, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too. So we are soon to be going to a top-of-the-hour CBS News break here, folks, and just in the last minute or so, I've got a few seconds left. I want to remind you about the podcast of the Dave Graham Show. If you miss part of the program in its 9 to 11 time block on weekday mornings, you can always go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, you'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest. And meanwhile, right now, we're going to go to some CBS News and a couple words from sponsors. We'll be back with Tom Squitieri from Talk Media News in just a couple minutes.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store.
The Seasons collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, continuing into the second hour of our program on this Friday morning, August 30th, 2019. And we've got a good hour of radio still to go here, folks. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, it's a little bit of ideological bookends here, I guess you'd call it, on the Dave Graham Show today. We frequently talk about welcoming all points of view. And, of course, we had a good staunch conservative, Christian Trump supporter, Guy Page, on talking to us this morning to lead off the show. And we're gonna end the show with Bill Boardman. William Boardman is a essayist, a columnist, and is definitely takes a left perspective and a very critical perspective of a lot of what the United States foreign policy, domestic policy, et cetera, has been over the last decades. So we'll be hearing from Bill in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to bring in Tom Squitieri. He's with Talk Media News, and he's going to be talking to us, broaden the lens. Well, we're going to have a good broad lens with Bill Boardman, too. But we're going to be visiting first with Tom Squitieri. Tom, what's your top headline this morning?
Hey, good morning. Happy Friday to you.
And to you.
Well, you know, my top headline, of course, is the hurricane is threatening the coast. And from the Pentagon perspective, it's worrisome because there's a lot of military installations there. But there's so much going on. It's one of those mornings where the every spot in the world seems to be on edge. You know, the president has decided maybe to recommend against sending weapons to Ukraine, which the Pentagon wants. Japan and South Korea are deepening this angrily rift between the two of them, which jeopardizes the alliance with the United States against North Korea and China. China and Vietnam are getting close to exchanging blows over an island in the South China Sea. And, you know, there's the whole Taliban asserting the fact that it essentially has won the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So a lot to keep me busy on this Friday before the weekend.
It almost reminds me, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, years ago there was this Kingston Trio tune about all this strife all around the world, and it was like, there was one line in there where it said, South Africans hate the Dutch, and I don't like anybody very much.
Yeah, and I remember that song. That's pretty old, too.
And, you know, there are times when you just almost want to just throw up your hands and go, this whole place has gone crazy. We don't know.
Yeah, and that's just the skim of the top, too.
Yeah.
You know, you have Israel has been launching missile attacks and strikes against different places in the Middle East, making situations very bad for the United States, particularly in Iraq. They Israel hit some spots in Iraq, which is, you know, the U.S.'s ally in a sense, trying to against Iran.
Yeah.
That's the second wave of things to talk about. You know, we didn't even, those are just sort of the headlines I gave you.
Yeah, so there's the kind of top-tier madness, second-tier madness. It's probably a third tier, which we would never get to. But it is, I mean, Asia itself, if you just look at everything going on over there from Hong Kong to this rift between South Korea and Japan, is historically, what is the cause of this rift between South Korea?
I'll tell you that. You're absolutely right. I didn't even mention Hong Kong, as you said. And we didn't even mention India and Pakistan, which is still fuming, you know. So, yeah, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
The historical part of the rift is historical. In World War II, the Japanese Empire occupied the Korean Peninsula as part of in China. And it was not a benevolent occupation.
No. Okay,
so that still, you know, is in the craw of Koreans, North and South. And
yeah,
we're talking now about South Korea. There has been recently an added element of a trade dispute between the two countries on Japan holding back or putting tariffs on parts needed for electronic goods that are made in South Korea, among other things. So that has created bad feelings between the two countries. Then you may remember a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago now, you and I talked about how a Russian plane entered airspace above an island in the Sea of Japan. The island is claimed by both South Korea and Japan. Okay,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So South Koreans sent fighters up to get the plane out of there. Japan then filed a protest against Russia for entering its airspace, and South Korea for entering its airspace. Okay,
yeah.
So that really irritated the South Koreans as well. That was sort of the military, added the military element to this economic feud. So about a week and a half ago, South Korea unilaterally left this intelligence-sharing pact that it had with Japan that had been written and fostered by the United States. And in the press conference that they had with reporters Wednesday at the Pentagon, General Dunford, who's chair of the Joint Chiefs, admitted, you know, this is a setback for us because, us meaning the alliance, it was a valuable intelligence gathering and sharing pact, operation for North Korea and China and to a lesser extent Russia. There are other ways to share information, but not as well as this. And so the Pentagon has this concern that the goal of Russia and China, which is to fracture that alliance, may be succeeding.
Yeah, it is... South Korea and Japan is just—it's a headache that nobody really wants to have pop up right now because there's enough else going on over.
Yeah, you know, when the Secretary of Defense, whoever he is or she is, but it's always been he so far here, visits that part of Asia, they always go to both countries. They will never go to Japan and not South Korea, or South Korea and not Japan. Otherwise, you know, just asking for trouble. You know, even if it's just an afternoon stop in.
They
meet their counterparts or whoever, and they show that it's an equal alliance. And I remember going with to Asia with then Secretary Mattis, and he had a trilateral meeting with the two defense ministers from Japan and one from South Korea, and they both were relatively new at the time. And he had hoped that this new, you know, the new freshness of them would help ease some of the animosities that still exist. And apparently, I mean, it did for a while, but this obviously is a bad turn.
So this proposed deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan, this is a deal between the Taliban and U.S. forces, I gather?
The Taliban, and I think it's technically going to be with NATO.
With NATO,
yeah,
okay.
With U.S. forces, Western forces. But the U.S. is driving it, and they're the ones negotiating with the Taliban. And of course, the focal point is U.S. troops and Taliban good behavior. You know, President Trump again said yesterday that troops would go down. He said to 8,000. There's about 15,000 now. Other reports have them dropping down to 6,000 or 5,000. I think that we have to look at these numbers kind of like a tout sheet at the racetrack. You know, it's going to change every day depending on the condition of the horse.
Yeah.
Sorry for that, revealing my one dark side.
your one bad habit, is that the idea? Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan could end up being the new name of that part of the world, and this is of course the name of their former hardline regime there. Big propaganda coup for
huge,
the insurgents.
That was what it was called before September 11th attacks.
It's
gone. That Taliban, they don't rule Afghanistan anymore, of course. And now they control maybe half the territory, mostly rural, but still half the territory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure. And you know, Dave, I'm really cautious about these sort of steps because every week the dynamics of this negotiation change. And that's how negotiations are. They're being played out in the media behind closed doors.
Yep.
So, you know, this name is something that's being sought, and the reports suggest that they're going to get it. This is one of the things I'll believe it when I see it. You know, when it happens, and then it happens. It's a big propaganda victory, and it also would tell me that it shows how determined the U.S. is to kind of get its footprint a lot smaller than Afghanistan. Most people I speak with in the Pentagon have no illusions about trusting the Taliban, as well as, you know, people who I consider smart on the matter outside of the Pentagon, you know, and think tanks and other institutions in Congress. And so, you know, it's facing a reality is there's nothing going to change unless you change something. General Dunford said that Wednesday at the press conference. I'm paraphrasing now, but you sort of have to change the dynamic in Afghanistan or else we're going to have the same thing all, you know, forever, which is not, you know, not something the United States wants.
For sure. Hey, one quick question about a domestic story here, if you're up on it. And that is this, it's kind of exploding over the past couple of days, this business about young children who are sick in U.S. hospitals, often have very serious illnesses and so on. Their families are suddenly getting deportation notices, and there are some who are calling these cases, you know, death warrants for these young kids who would have to go back to countries that don't offer the kinds of medical care.
Yeah, I saw... I saw a headline on that this morning, and I don't know much more about it than what you just said. It involves immigrant families or migrant families, I presume, and not American citizens.
These are immigrant families who are getting deportation notices, and essentially they're saying, you know, they have strong humanitarian reasons for wanting to stay in the United States and continue to allow their kids to get the medical care they need to, in some cases, apparently stay alive.
I mean, if it's true, there's reports, and I'm not suggesting the reports are not true, but if true, it would suggest to me, it'd say to me, this is part of a larger pattern of tightening restrictions, tightening benefits, tightening access to the United States in all forms to migrants and immigrants. I mean, it's been the pattern of this White House and the Trump administration. And that's one more thing. It's all these things that you can seemingly do unilaterally. If you look at President Trump's first, you know, 2.5 years in office, what's the signature? What's the signature legislative goal or triumph of it? Maybe a tax cut? You know, what really has gotten through Congress that's of headline making news, good or bad? Almost all of the actions from the Trump administration have been through executive order, unilateral action, things that the president can do without on his own, in other words. You know, and most of them in regards to immigration have been hostile to migrants. You know, not so much tightening the border, but, you know, the care that they allegedly receive or don't receive in the centers on the border.
Yeah.
You know, this incident, the order earlier this week that children born to some American families overseas will not automatically be U.S. citizens. I don't know if you saw that or not.
Right.
You know, these are all unilateral actions, but they're all sort of hostile actions.
Yeah, I get you. And I just, you know, I still have this longstanding question now, which is, you know, I know that Trump gets quite a bit of very solid support around the country from evangelicals. And I go back to the scriptural lines about, you know, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Now I was sick and you cared for me, all in that same section of the gospel according to Matthew. And I just have to keep asking, how is it that anybody who believes it, follows that scripture and the faith based on it, can support what this administration is up to?
Yeah, you know, my take is, you know, you can find anything you want in the Bible to support a position. We all know that. My take on it is that I think this country is strong enough, smart enough, financially enough stable to come up with a way to deal with the border crises, deal with the border issue, have a plan for the border that can be both efficient, fair to Americans, and humanitarian to those who seek to enter our country. I don't think that's an impossible goal.
Well, we'll talk again, Tom, and see if we have any clues on how to get there, because
I don't think it's an impossible goal. I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Hey, Tom, I appreciate your getting on the air with us very much, and I'm off next week. We'll talk again the week of the 9th, I expect. So,
Thank you.
Thanks. Yep, take care. Right. I want to introduce my next guest, Bill Boardman. William Boardman is a resident of the town of Woodstock down in Windsor County, and he is quite a prolific writer who in recent years has been an essayist for an organization called Reader Supported News. I almost said Talk Media News, but that was the last segment, folks. Don't get me confused. Oh wait, I'm confusing myself. Okay, so Bill Boardman is a writer for Reader Supported News, and you know, as I mentioned, we began a show with Guy Page, who was a conservative commentator in Vermont on a wide range of issues, and wanted to get the other end of the political spectrum on the show as well, because we welcome all points of view here on the Dave Graham Show. Bill Boardman, is it fair to say that you take a somewhat left critical perspective? Is that right?
Well, I wanted to. Hi, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for joining me this morning, by the way. All those niceties.
I did want to comment on that. I mean, I guess in the ordinary scheme of things, I'm easily perceived as left. Mm-hmm. But I don't think of myself as particularly left as so much as radical centrist.
Radical centrist, okay.
I mean, here's the joke that frames that. Mm-hmm. The 2016 election, the bad news was that Trump won. The good news was that Hillary lost.
Yeah, I've actually been dabbling in this this reason you are here, which I also should introduce at the top of the segment here. Bill Boardman is his essays for Reader Supported News have been collected up into a large tome here, a thick paperback book called "Exceptional: American Exceptionalism Takes Its Toll," and he is not an apologist for Democrats by any means. From what I read here, there was. You've been quite critical of this sort of the famous Washington consensus, which very much was the foreign policy feature of the Obama administration, and with Hillary Clinton and then John Kerry as secretaries of state. And we can talk a little bit about that. But that's why I went there to the left as a political descriptor, only because it seems as though you are you do critique. The whole U.S. governmental system and what it has done around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't think the left-right paradigm is a very useful analytical tool.
Okay. Radical centrist. What is a radical centrist?
Well, start with the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
We have a president who has been impeachable since the day he was sworn in. Since the moment he was sworn in, he's violating both the domestic emolument and the foreign emolument clauses in the Constitution, which in plain English means he's enriching himself through being president.
Enriching himself through being president. Now, he talked the other day about having the next G7 summit at one of his resorts in Florida, the Doral, I guess it's called.
Right.
And is that what you're talking about in this?
Well, that's a late hit in the game.
Mm-hmm.
He's been his Washington hotel has been operating to his benefit with foreign and domestic visitors since day one.
This is the Trump International Hotel, I believe it is.
Right, in the old post office.
The former U.S. Post Office headquarters.
So, yeah, basically, he's his own landlord at this point.
Mm-hmm. Explain that to me. What do you mean by he's his own landlord?
Well, the building is leased from the Postal Service.
Okay. So as head of the government, they technically own the building and therefore the hotel... He's his own tenant, could say.
I mean, one of the reasons there's some vagueness right here is because nobody's really looked hard at it.
Hmm.
But making the case is not that hard. All you have to do is assign a staffer to it full time, and you will find that there have been emolument violations probably daily. Not only in Washington, but all at his other places. Yeah. I mean, when he holds a cabinet meeting at Mar-a-Lago, what's that about?
I guess the other question I have about the conduct of U.S. foreign policy is people talk about the Trump administration as being unusually kind to the regime of Vladimir Putin in Russia. And, of course, Trump is... has been wanting to build a big real estate project in Moscow, the Trump Tower, Moscow, for years now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the story you just talked about a few minutes ago about no arms to Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
that is obviously has a pro-Russian spin to it, if you want to see it that way. I don't know the background on it. But the whole Ukraine thing has been a mess that was created by the Obama administration. We went about undermining their president.
Refresh me now. What did the Obama administration do that made things a mess in Ukraine?
Do you remember when, what was his name, Zurakrinsky or whatever? I don't know the name. I forget the name. I didn't prepare this part because I didn't know it was coming up right before we got on. But there was the maiden demonstrations in the 2014. It's not in my book.
Okay.
but we were over there involved in the Maidan protests and promoting the opposition to Dinghy. I'm looking it up. It's in my prologue. my introduction.
The opposition to the Russian influences in Ukraine.
I wrote a lot about this in the wake of the U.S.-backed overthrow of Ukraine's elected government president in 2014. At the moment, Ukraine is on simmer, and I talk about it briefly in the NATO piece in the book at the end of the America Saves the World section. Ukraine made more news when it elected Volodymyr Zelensky president in April of this year. His preparation for the presidency consists of principally of playing president of Ukraine in the popular TV series Servant of the People, after which he named his Servant of the People party. But the Maidan protest in 2014 forced out I was hoping his name would be in here, the president that was essentially a pro-Russian president.
Mm-hmm.
And the crux of Ukraine is that we want Ukraine in NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how would we feel if the Russians or the Chinese wanted Mexico in their military alliance? It is just a fundamentally stupid, provocative idea.
That is definitely an argument that makes some sense. I think that when you have an interesting way of examining things, Bill Boardman, and frequently. You sort of unpack things and try to apply analogies, common sense, balance, and
rational
and,
thought.
Rational thought. That's the phrase. That's the phrase I'm looking for. It escapes me sometimes. But radically rational maybe is one way to describe what we're looking at here, folks. Listen. Here's a little excerpt from the introduction to Exceptional American Exceptionalism Takes Its Toll by William Boardman. Most Americans were taught to believe in American superiority long before we were able to think for ourselves. Quote, America is the greatest country in the world, unquote. It's an article of faith. It can't be proved. Other countries didn't vote us number one in a free and fair election. What is the measure of greatness for a country? Do genocide, slavery, racism, imperialism, and endemic poverty count? If the United States is really the greatest country in the world, what does that say about the world? And I guess I'm almost forced into the... Well, we'll, you know what we'll do? You know what we'll do is we will pick this up right after the break for some bottom of the hour CBS news and a couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back shortly, folks.
I wish I had a dollar for every compliment I get about our selection upstairs at the Warren Store. This season's collection boasts country casual clothing for men and women, dresses for summer weddings and events, baby clothing from Zuchano and Doodle Pants, and fair trade jewelry from around the world. I'm excited about a new line of pottery from Londonderry, Vermont. Also, illuminated paper stars for outdoor fun. It's a great day trip to Warren Village. Come for lunch on the deck and upstairs for some unique retail therapy. Fun, funky, and friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back, continuing into our second hour of the Dave Graham Show, and it's Friday, August the 30th, 2019. Bill Boardman, William Boardman, is my guest, and he is the author of Exceptional, American Exceptionalism Takes Its Toll. It is a collection of essays which are pretty universally critical of the United States and its activities in the world, and certainly within its own borders as well. Just before the break, I was reading, I'll read the second part of this excerpt again from the introduction. It says, what is the measure of greatness for a country? Do genocide, slavery, racism, imperialism, and endemic poverty count? If the United States is really the greatest country in the world, what does that say about the world? And Bill, I want to get right into that, because I think that what may distinguish the United States from a lot of other places in the world, and some of these other things, frankly, don't. I think you'd agree that genocide has occurred elsewhere in the world.
Absolutely.
Slavery, racism, all of this stuff has occurred in many, many places in human history. The United States has two things going for it, in my estimation, that maybe have not existed in other places to the same degree or with the same codification in its founding documents. And one is in the preamble to the Constitution. There's this discussion about in order to form a more perfect union. And that has always struck me as an invitation to continuous improvement in our society.
I don't think you can read it any other way, and it is the first item.
Yeah.
In the preamble to the Constitution.
The we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice,
ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the
general welfare. Yeah.
And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Well, you're reading. I was going to try to do it from memory.
Well, I try not to.
Thanks
do
for
that
help.
Because
thanks
I
for
always,
help.
I always fail.
Yeah. Well, then, in addition to that, in addition to this invitation to continuous improvement, we do have this thing called the First Amendment, which talks about the. Starts with freedom of religion, both in establishment or no establishment. Well, actually, what it says is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press.
And if you read that carefully, mm-hmm. It's Congress shall make no law respecting that, and it establishes freedom from religion.
Freedom from religion.
Respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, there won't be an establishment of religion. We won't have a state religion.
No state religion in the United States.
And part of the whole Christian thrust of the recent decades has been toward theocracy.
Now, just on this point, though, the United States has these tools in its toolkit of an invitation to continuous improvement, and it has the ability to speak out about flaws. That's codified in the First Amendment. Yeah. I'm pretty sure your book, if an analog to it were being published in, or somebody were trying to publish it in Russia today, about imperialism and racism and other problems in Russian society, I don't think you'd be on a regular commercial radio station talking about it over there.
Okay, but that's a whataboutism argument. It doesn't really deal with the core issues, which I'm dealing with.
No, but I only raise that, and I agree, whataboutism is a real problem in our political discourse, and I don't like to go there generally, but the reason I bring that up is only to point out that we have a chance in the United States of America that other places don't seem to give themselves.
I absolutely agree with that. And that's what makes it so desperate and sad, because we're blowing the chance right now. When the Constitution was written, black people were 3/5 of a person, and only for the census. Otherwise, they didn't exist as people. We've had doublethink from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. And yet now we are at a place where you hope that the normal way of thinking about black people in America is that each black person counts as a full person. Certainly, when you hear things like Black Lives Matter, I think that's where that's going.
Black Lives Matter. Where did Black Lives Matter come from? Black Lives Matter came from white cops shooting black people, often unarmed.
I've sometimes said, and especially in response to the pushback you hear sometimes, where someone will say, well, yeah, all lives matter. And I'll say, yeah, the difference is that Black Lives Matter is actually a news item.
Yeah, well, all lives matter is a cop-out. Black Lives Matter speaks to a particular problem. And I have a long section in the book called Black in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy being black in America, and we don't appreciate, as a culture, we don't appreciate the difficulty. And the police unions are among the more horrible aspects of that. Every time, even in Vermont, when Abu Mumia Jamal wanted to speak at the Goddard commencement and he was going to speak remotely, Vermont cops went crazy.
I remember that was a huge controversy Jamal, who's imprisoned in Pennsylvania in the shooting of a police officer down there and has been tell us his story. Why is he considered? Why would he be invited to Goddard College to speak?
Well, first of all, he's a graduate. He has been an outspoken commentator for decades. His conviction in the shooting of the police officer was flawed in a number of ways. It's never been sorted out. He had a racist judge. He had an all-white jury. It's been back and forth to the Supreme Court. One of the pieces in my book is about Adig Bailey, a lawyer who represented Jamal and was nominated by Obama for the Civil Rights Division head in the Justice Department. And the cops went crazy and eventually blocked the nomination of a highly qualified lawyer simply because he had a client, briefly, that they didn't like. I mean, it was about as anti-constitutional and illiberal as you can get.
Yeah, that kind of pushback where people are punished, lawyers are being punished these days sometimes for quote-unquote representing the wrong client is does run contrary to the principle in American law that every defendant gets representation.
Yes, which is something of a joke anyway.
That's but the principle exists.
The principle is there. Yeah. The fact is a whole other game.
So much in this in this book, you were mentioning on the break that it does have a structure to it that where you break down the essays that are included in the book in under several sort of section headings here. We talk about voting versus elections being one of the first ones, and just to give a couple of examples.
Let me run through it, if I might.
Absolutely.
First of all, the book has one of the world's longest epigraphs. It is the Nuremberg Principles.
Yeah.
Of war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's the epigraph because that's one of the frames through which I look at American behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any serious question that America has committed war crimes consistently over many decades.
Now, just as a history lesson for listeners who may not be familiar, the Nuremberg Principles developed after World War II.
And we developed them. We were instrumental. The United States was instrumental in developing the Nuremberg Principles for the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi leaders that survived.
And the among the things that are considered crimes against peace would be planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of war of aggression or a war in violation of international treaties, agreements, or assurances.
I would say Iraq was one example, and our participation in Yemen is another current vivid example.
Participation in a common plan or conspiracy for the accomplishment of any of the acts mentioned under number one. War crimes, violations of laws or customs of war, which include but are not included to murder, ill treatment, or deportation to slave labor or for any of the other purposes of civilian population of or in occupied territory, murder or ill treatment of prisoners of war or persons on the seas, killing of hostages, plunder of public or private property, wanton the destruction of cities, towns, or villages, or devastation not justified by military necessity. And, of course, these things all being put on lists of banned things after World War II, and pretty understandable at that point in history that these would be high on the list.
Absolutely. And we are chronically perpetrating them both in Afghanistan and in our participation with the Saudi and United Arab Emirates aggressive war on Yemen.
Bill, you have a section in the book called Criminalizing Free Speech, and this is free speech, obviously, something dear to my heart. I've just been talking about it. What are we doing to criminalize free speech?
Okay, that's one essay from 2013. I'm not looking at it right now. It's in the is that in the voting and election section? I start with voting because that to me is one of the America loses altitude. That's section two. Okay, I'll get right there. But first, voting.
Voting.
Because I think that has been a chronic, crucial, cultural, political failure of this country, at least since 2001. Not only did the Supreme Court choose the president in 2001, but the basis on which the situation that was created, it allowed them to do that, was voter caging, voter roll purging, and so on by Jeb Bush's administration in Florida, creating an electorate that was not an honest electorate. And that has been a widespread Republican tactic throughout the country. I have a piece in here about Georgia there. The piece that opens the book is about Pennsylvania, where a Republican guy celebrates having accomplished electing what's his name who didn't win, you know, the governor, the Utah guy,
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, thank you. Romney care. Right now, the first thing that the Democrats did when they regained control of the House this year was to pass H.R. 1, which is a broad voter reform act. And the Senate will not act on it because Mitch McConnell is stonewalling it.
You know, that excerpt I read back in the a few minutes ago was basically all about that, about hearing all the time that America is the world's greatest country and so on. And yet we do have problems. And as I argued a couple minutes later and just a bit ago now, we have the ability to address our problems via via things like the free and independent press. And Bill Boardman, you come under that umbrella, don't you, in your writing?
I don't see how I don't.
Yeah. And yet you have some criticisms that of the mainstream media that you feel as though they often come up short in terms of their ability or willingness to take on the powers that be in our country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a unique observation. I think the mainstream media are generally expected not to push things too far. The conversation you had earlier was the news conversation right before I came on was riddled with American exceptionalist perceptions. I mean, framing Afghanistan as though the most important thing is American troops there, that is American exceptionalism at work. No, the most important thing about Afghanistan is not whether or not American troops are there killing people. The most important thing is not whether the CIA is there killing people. The most important thing about Afghanistan is whether or not the Afghans can have a decent life somehow.
And you know what's interesting is that that is going to be the perspective out there, folks, in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. I mean, if you live in India, let's say, which is closer geographically than any place in the United States to Afghanistan, and you're looking at Afghanistan, you don't have this same sense of frankly American perspective that we get from our media in this country for sure.
And the same with Yemen. I mean, how many people know anything about Yemen?
Talk to us about Yemen a little bit. Why should people be concerned about Yemen?
Because we are committing war crimes there. We are participating in an aggressive war that is, by definition, a war crime under the Nuremberg principles. For reasons that I've never understood, the Obama administration said to the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, sure, go ahead and attack Yemen. There was no casus belli. There was no reason for any attack. As best I can gather, the calculation was the Saudis were annoyed that Obama was making a deal with Iran, which I think is a very good thing. And in order to placate the Saudis, he said he gave them a green light and military support to attack Yemen. Yemen has become the world's most horrible humanitarian crisis, and it's greatly our fault.
What did the Saudi government say about Yemen? Why was the Saudi, I mean, obviously, you know, we could go out and attack some neighboring country of ours that is considered to be considerably weaker militarily and so on. The United States could attack Mexico, but you would expect the United States would announce some cause for attacking Mexico if it were to do that.
Exactly. Insofar as there is a reason for the war in Yemen, it largely has to do, as far as I can tell, it has to do with the largely imaginary threat from Iran. The Houthis, who control most of northwestern Yemen, are a long time sect of Shiite Muslims, but they've been there forever in their own little world. Mm-hmm. They have an actual real estate dispute with the Saudis, but the cover is that they're puppets of Iran. Well, I think what's happened is the war has created a self-fulfilling prophecy, and now the Houthis have probably Iranian-made drones that are attacking the Saudi oil industry.
Sort of like if you didn't have a problem before, you can go ahead and create one now, folks.
Absolutely. And the irony is that these people, the Saudis have not put troops on the ground. It's been entirely an air war. The United Arab Emirates have put troops on the ground in the south, and now there's a separatist movement in Aden, and Aden has been going back and forth between control by the quote-unquote legitimate government and or the United Arab Emirates and the separatist Yemenis, none of whom are Houthis.
It's
it gets complicated. There's a lot about it in the book.
Yeah, and that is the kind of issue that people may have a vague notion that there are real problems in U.S. foreign policy in a place like Yemen. And if you want to inform yourself and get a perspective on this that is sometimes pretty tough on the United States, frequently, you might do well to have a look at this book called Exceptional: American Exceptionalism Takes Its Toll. It's put together by William Boardman. It's a collection of his essays for reader-supported news over the past...
You can buy it right now.
Yep.
At Phoenix Bookstore on Bank Street in Burlington.
In Burlington. You're going to be there today, right?
I'm going to be there today. I'm going to be doing a book signing. Please come.
1 o'clock, is it?
1 o'clock.
And you have some other events upcoming? We just have a minute or so to go. Yeah, maybe we can squeeze a couple
of things.
The book's
also available at the Yankee Bookshop in Woodstock. There'll be an event there in October. And you can always get the book from yorklandpublishing.com online.
Yorklandpublishing.com. Well, Bill Boardman, I wish we had more time to delve into this, but we are fast approaching the top of the hour, and I thank you for coming in today. Bill Boardman, the author of Exceptional, American Exceptionalism Takes Its Toll, by William Boardman, and he'll be at the Phoenix Books in Burlington today at 1 o'clock if you want to stop by and visit with him and maybe pick up a copy of the book. There you go, folks. That's about it for today's Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And I appreciate my guests, Guy Page, Katrina Brackett from Moorfest, and, of course, Mike Calhoun from Florida talking about the coming hurricane. And we'll be back on Monday. Actually, no, Monday's Labor Day. So next week I'll be back on the 9th of September. I'm going to take a few days off, folks. Have a great weekend and week to follow, everybody, and we'll talk to you on September 9th.
Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.